Alexander Berkman writes an essay called Invisible Revolution, where he says that all revolutions, when they begin, are never seen by the outside society. And in that essay, he talks a lot about the importance of language, that the language we use to describe our reality no longer corresponds to that reality. Gramsci mentions exactly the same thing and says that these periods when the language you use to describe your political, your economic, and social reality no longer match that reality are interregnums. They're periods of confusion. And I think that was probably where we are at this moment. We are seeing a situation where the language of opportunity provided by the capitalist system no longer corresponds to the reality that most Americans, indeed globally, most people are undergoing. That we are rapidly creating globally and domestically a kind of neo-feudalism, an oligarchic system. The language by which this corporate capitalism says that it will distribute wealth has changed from what it was in the 1950s when we had a labor movement, and labor was never organized above 40% in this country. Now, of course, it's less than 12%. Most of them are public service workers who can't strike. The language has changed where it's now said that when an oligarchic class amasses great sums of wealth, it trickles down and creates opportunities. That is, of course, just as much a lie as the previous system of economic distribution, and I think we still haven't yet figured out a vision, and we haven't figured out a language to describe what is happening to us in a system of global capitalism, which is different from 19th century robber baron capitalism, because global capitalism is supranational. It has no loyalty to any particular nation state. The Carnegies, the Rockefellers, the Mellons, they created rapacious conditions for workers, and of course in the American labor wars were the bloodiest in the industrialized world. I mean, hundreds of workers were killed, thousands were wounded. Now we're seeing a system whereby they are hollowing the country out. Our manufacturing, of course, has gone overseas. They have created a security and surveillance apparatus because they know what's coming. They are accelerating the climate crisis, and rapidly have already, of course, destroyed the working class and are rapidly destroying the middle class. And I would just end by saying that what makes some kind of revolt or revolution within the United States and probably most of the world, and historians have often written that revolutions come in waves, whether it's 1848 or 1917 or wherever. What makes it inevitable is that the system is now so completely beholden to corporate interest that in a political sense it's paralyzed. It can no longer respond to the needs of citizens. It doesn't matter what we want. It doesn't matter what we vote for. We are just day by day being further disempowered and further fleeced. And in this sense, Marx was right. Unfettered, unregulated capitalism is a revolutionary force that, because it has no self-imposed limits and because it commodifies everything, human beings become commodities, the natural world becomes a commodity that exploits until exhaustion or collapse, will push and push and push until there is some kind of blowback. What it looks like, I don't know. That it's coming, I do know. And I will just close by saying that because our radical movements were destroyed after World War I in what Dwight MacDonald calls the psychosis of permanent war, it first, of course, in the name of anti-communism, now the iconography and language has changed in the name of the war on terror, we are seeing a situation where the right-wing proto-fascist movements that celebrate the gun culture, that demonize the marginalized, that's the Tea Party, that's the lunatic fringe of the Republican Party, that's the Christian right, are empowered, while those of us who care about an egalitarian populist movement have never been weaker in American history. And I think we can't discount the fact that oftentimes when there is a revolt, that revolt can be expressed through the most retrograde elements of American capitalism, which unfortunately at this moment in American history are virulent and strong, while those of us who come out of progressive and radical movements have been, are anemic and marginalized and largely shut down.
So I think that revolution is a process. Politically, revolution is the violent overthrow of one class by another. What you end up with after the revolution can be good or it can be bad, and that's the result. But revolution is that process. And unfortunately, because so many people who are maybe younger than 60 have never seen revolutionary politics in the United States, really since the end of the 1960s and early 1970s, and I'm 50 and I've never seen them. There's so much confusion on the left that people don't even really know what a revolution is. They will talk about the independence struggle in India or the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa and say, look, those were revolutions. Those weren't revolutions at all. They were notable. They were important. They were struggles, but they were not revolutions. Had there been a revolution, the rich who were rich before would no longer be rich now. The poor who were poor before would no longer be poor now. And a revolution leads to the radical transformation of society in terms of its culture, its art, its religion, even its measuring systems in the case of the French Revolution. So everything changes. And we haven't seen very many of those real revolutions, actual revolutions in history since the demise of feudalism. So it's hard to even, it's easy to get confused and point to things like Tunisia and Tahrir Square and say, and the media likes to confuse the issue and say, those are, you know, the Egyptian revolution. There was no revolution in Egypt. The existing power structure remained in power. And that point was brought home by the fact that the generals took over in a brutal coup that made the previous regime look like something that people might miss. So I think it's really important to define our terms. Unfortunately, you can't even go anywhere until you have.
I think it's really interesting that we can all have so many different opinions and all of us be right about something that I think that we all have in our heads. Revolution, like we know what it is. It's this thing. There's a specific definition for it, yet all of us have different definitions for it, and I think that all of us are right. I think that revolution is energy. It's and people can carry it, and I think it's also ruptures in our society in the status quo of how we're living, and I think through those ruptures, truth is allowed to come through, and I think energy comes through those ruptures and moves us to act, and if I sound like an artist, it's because I am. I also think there's a worldwide revolution happening now. I don't think it's a cataclysmic one-time event. I think it's something that happens in stages. I think it's growing. I think it's inevitable. The society as we know it is blowing apart. The planet is under siege. There is no way for this to hold what we're living right now. And there have been many, many ruptures all over the world already. And there are some happening here. Occupy Wall Street was one of them. And I also see smaller things happening here in America that point towards a revolution. I see a food revolution happening. People are growing food all over the place. You see where civilization is coming down, like places like Detroit. People are starting to grow food because they have no other choice. And that gives me a lot of hope because, you know, when all else fails, people know what to do, which is to go back to the land. They're tearing up vacant lots and lawns and whatever ground that they can find and seeding it and growing food for themselves. So that's not just happening in Detroit. There's a man in L.A., South Central L.A., who calls himself the gangster gardener, and he's brilliant. He tore up a patch of land outside of his apartment building, and he planted food there, And he was sick of, like, walking outside of his apartment and seeing all these fast food restaurants and having to travel 45 minutes for an actual apple. And then he saw all these dialysis centers coming up, and he just made this connection, like, I need to eat real food. And so he started this community gardens movement, and now they're growing all over South Central L.A. We have a collection of gardeners here in New York City on Facebook, the Green Thumbs Network. And these seem like small little things, but they're not. This is people taking the land back. I mean, this is land that belongs to the state, to the city, but it's been vacant, and they're taking it back, and they're seeding it, and they're growing their own food. And it's happening all over. It's happening in suburbia. They're growing food on their front lawns. They're, you know, emptying out their swimming pools and growing it there. So I see that, and it gives me hope. The other thing that I see is that the indigenous movement in this country is growing in leaps and bounds, and they're getting a lot more people to align with them, to put their bodies between the extraction industries, the fossil fuel industries, and their land. And I think it's important, it's imperative that we support that process. More and more people have to go to the front lines and put their bodies between the extraction industries, or we're not going to have a planet left, and that's real. And the other thing that I see is... what was the other thing I was going to say? Oh, Ferguson, Missouri. Here we go. That is, you know, that's an energy that's let loose, man. That is, you know, unbridled, rage. Justifiable rage. And without an avenue to govern that kind of rage, we're going to have massive chaos. And that's just a small little breakout. That stuff is going to be happening all over America. We have food shortages. We have water shortages all over the world that haven't hit us yet. And it's hard to imagine in our comfort zone that we live in today that this is going to happen to us. But it is coming, and we had better prepare for it. So if we don't learn to harness that energy and by promoting an underground militant faction that can train that kind of energy to do what it's supposed to do, to hit the right targets, we're going to have bloody chaos. And as a woman, that terrifies me even more than climate change, because women become the fodder in war like that.
Thank you all for coming. As all the panelists said, I think this question, what is revolution? I mean, it's something that I know many of you, and you know, we have these conversations over cups of coffee and walking down the street or at all the different rallies and protests. And I think it is true, kind of what was said, that it is something that is a word that has been taken away from us, and that many of us, I include myself, don't really even know what it means. And I don't know that there is, like, a specific meaning to revolution. I think Chevy has a meaning for revolution. The green energy movement has a meaning for revolution. The Che Guevarists have another meaning for revolution. And I think the indigenous are starting or continuing their 500 years of revolution. Here in the U.S. and abroad, and for me, you know, as somebody who identifies as an American, as the top 1% probably globally, I think of this one quote that I always read that stays with me is, "Don't speak to me of revolution unless you're ready to eat rats," and it really hit me like a ton of bricks, because here we are, you know, having all this revolutionary talk, and this is something that I self-critique, and. You know, as somebody who comes from a global sense of privilege, the privilege that I have when I go to places abroad, you know, I go to these very poor, you know, campesino villages. Now, the privilege that I have is inherent in my belief of the world, and it is not something that I'm going to give up, regardless of how radical or revolutionary I think that I am. And I think that what a revolution is for me is working towards creating systems that are going to take that privilege away, that are going to make me eat rats. Because I think only then, when we're ready to do that, when we're ready to prepare systems that are going to take the privilege away that have allowed us to create those systems, then we can have a revolution. And I think a lot of this talk here in New York City, especially with the climate change march coming up, this idea of sustainability, you know, there's an inherent unsustainability of talk of sustainability. And I think that that's something that we really have to come to terms with when we talk about this in America, you know, this idea of revolution. It will be us that lose. And I think as radical or revolutionary is something that should be our goal.
you had to go back to people like Andrea Dworkin in order to get a rational critique of porn. You weren't getting it out of, and I'm not pretending in any way to be particularly well-versed in the feminist movement, but I kept looking for contemporary feminists who are critiquing porn the way Dworkin did, and her book on pornography is brilliant. And in fact, when I wrote that chapter, I tried to sell it as a magazine piece to Harper's and Nation and other, and their response to me, and we're talking about, you know, liberal, progressive, was that it was a free speech issue. And I almost fell over. The idea that a, you know, woman who is abused in a sweatshop, you know, deserves dignity and rights, but somehow a woman who is, and let's not forget that people, and I interviewed the women who work in the industry, are physically abused. I mean, they're all taking handfuls of painkillers, they're black and blue, but somehow women who are exploited and physically abused in the sex industry, it just was mind-boggling. So I was just on the fringe of it, but I caught what you alluded to, was that this redefinition of feminism, you know, it, to essentially denude it of any radical critique. That's the first thing. The other thing I would just add is the way that we guard against it, and this has been my critique of the Black Bloc, and I know Derek's critique of the Black Bloc, for which we've taken some heat, is we cannot allow resistance movements to define themselves through hypermasculinity, because essentially they import the very disease of the hypermasculine culture they are opposed against. And that really was at the core of my critique of the Black Bloc, as I know it is at the core of Derek Jensen's critique of the Black Bloc, that these are hyper-masculine movements. And having spent 20 years of my life as a war correspondent, violence itself to hyper-masculine movements is eroticized. Power is eroticized. And it's no accident that in every war that I ever covered, there is an explosion of the porn industry and sex trafficking, because what war does is it turns other human beings into objects, which is exactly what sex exploitation does to women. It turns them into objects. And that's why in all of the war zones that I was in, you saw a massive, growth of sex exploitation and porn and snuff films. Because essentially that's hyper-masculine culture of war becomes translated into the culture itself. So my caveat, and I think one of the reasons I've been so harsh with the Black Bloc, is because I fear that hyper-masculinity, which we cannot allow to infect movements of resistance, otherwise we become no different than the white male hyper-masculine power structure that we are trying to dismantle.
Should be women need to be more recognized. If women need to be in positions of leadership, because often you don't hear about the women a lot. You often hear about the men. You often hear about Che. You often hear about other men, male revolutionaries. Women need to be more in positions of be empowered, be more in positions in leadership, and you can learn from other cultures, like in indigenous cultures, women held very high positions in ceremonies and in their communities. You can see, for example, Comandante Ramona from the Zapatistas. She held a very high rank, which is comandante, which is even more than Marcos, which is subcomandante. So she together with other women helped write the women's revolutionary law, which protects women from being raped, being forced into marriage, have rights, because we as women also have rights, and many indigenous women didn't know. The problem of patriarchy in most of South America and indigenous cultures was brought in by European thought. So we can learn from our ancestors, from our roots. We need to recognize those. So that's what I have to say. Thank you.
Give you a few examples about what I saw with the Zapatistas. because they have been really, really actively trying to fight against this whole idea of patriarchy and really, I mean, try to change a cultural bias that has been so deeply thought that we are no longer able to see how wrong and how twisted it is. So even just the merely fact of wondering what is the role of women in revolutions, we should be asking what's a revolution without women. And the Zapatistas basically, I mean, they had to realize, and this was a very hard process, that the tradition, some of the traditions that they have had for over 500 years were completely wrong. Because they were traditions that were basically maintaining the widespread patriarchy. So, for instance, the division of labor in their communities was very, very well fixed. So women were meant to stay in home, taking care of the children and cooking, and men were the ones that were working in the fields. And so they have been, I mean, they realized that they were repeating some of the patterns that they were criticizing for the rest of the society. So they decided to work to try to change those behaviors. And that was a really, really difficult thing to do because, as I was telling you, I mean, these are cognitive and cultural biases that are so deeply built on our society configuration that we no longer see them. We don't see what's wrong with the little things that we are doing. And it's not just like, oh, I realize this is wrong, I'm gonna change it. It doesn't work like that. You really, really have to think about ways of improving, the participation of women. So, I mean, for example, for the Zapatistas, a big challenge was the language. Because typically the men were used to be the ones that were sent to the school while the women were staying in their house. So the men were the ones that used to learn Spanish while the women usually don't. So what they decided to do is just say, okay, we don't care about whether you know or not Spanish. If you're willing to participate, we're going to teach you. And that has worked very well. At the end, they have ended up with a lot of community management that now have 50% men and 50% women. And women themselves, like, it's not that they have really, really fought for that position from the very beginning. So, I mean, I think this is just basically realizing that social movements more often than not reflect the society they are embedded into. And if we want to change that society, we really have to ask ourselves whether we're doing something that's right or whether we're just repeating the patterns that have been wrong.
I just want to say just a few quick words. I think that we need to take a stake and remember that we're living in a general era where on the ideological level, we've taken several steps back. As dominated classes, the ideology of the ruling classes have really been impressed on us. And one of the areas where we've gone back, even within the struggle, people involved in struggle, is the area of women's rights. I can remember it used to be standard practice whenever you had large events or even smaller events where there would be childcare afforded. Now, it's even bad to think as childcare as a responsibility of women because that's sexist too. So not only do we need to be men in progressive movements should be put through re-education because we need to break down. We need to learn. We need to go back, and it has to be a constant process. And I think that speaks exactly to some of the challenges that the Zapatistas actually built into their practices, and I'm really, it's mind-blowing. But I think that you also need to put forth some new paradigms. Just like childcare is not a woman's responsibility. That's bad. So even when we do childcare, it's not just for women's rights, it should be just as part of social equality in general. In the same regard, there needs to be, what do they call it, affirmative action. We need to have affirmative action because all oppressed people, all people who've been subjected to discrimination, face additional hurdles. And unless you break down, you have affirmative action to break down these hurdles, you have a process that keeps replicating itself where privilege builds upon privilege. So we need to have affirmative action. And we need to recognize that women need to have their own autonomous groupings, meaning that groupings of women, by women, to discuss women's issues, and where as that role that mostly has come to pass in our world because of the dominance of Occidental culture, and some Oriental cultures also, women need to organize autonomously to break that down and to have their own platforms, their own vehicles, where they can express their own point of views. Not necessarily against men, but from the autonomy and of a woman's perspective. And last, I'd like to say that the woman's struggle, just like the struggle of any dominated or any underprivileged minority, although women are a dominated majority, because women are a majority of the world. I'll just say that struggle needs to be viewed in the context of the struggle, the revolutionary struggle of dominated classes to throw out and overthrow the systems of exploitation and domination that have benefited by this setting these sexual roles, sexual division of labor, and putting down and women as categories that can be more readily exploited. Thank you.
First of all, women have been involved in revolutionary movements throughout history. They are there, and they are plentiful. You have, Asada Shakur and Elaine Brown in running the Black Panther movement. You have Celia Sanchez of the Cuban Revolution. You have Qi Jin of the Chinese Revolution. You have Maud Gunn. You have Sophie Scholl of the Nazi Resistance. Maud Gunn was part of the Irish Revolution. You have the Naxalites in India now who live in the jungle, which are very balanced in terms of men and women. You have the Gulabi Gang in India, which are tens of thousands of women strong. It's a women's movement. It's a women's gang. And what they do is they dress in pink saris, and they go throughout India and address domestic violence disputes with bamboo sticks. And they are enormously successful in procuring not only the end of battering in the relationship, but also in procuring the check, the paycheck of the man in the family who's battering their wife and giving it to the woman. And you also have women now from Turkey going into Iraq, and armed women going into Iraq and facing off the jihadists who have abducted over 3,000 innocent women and children. So they are there. They are there, and they are plentiful, and they are strong, strong warriors. But we don't hear about these women because we live under patriarchy, for one. And if women got wind of this and really acknowledged, were able to hear about our history, you know, other women fighting before us and what they accomplished, wow, would we be a force to contend with or what? I think that, you know, I talk to young women today about feminism from my generation. I mean, I'm 55. This only happened like 40 years ago, 35, 40 years ago. You know, that feminism, radical feminism, was a force in the society. They were out there in droves. They were naming names. They were relentless. They were rabid dogs on a mission, you know, and they got things done. They got laws changed. That's how it's done. you know, today women don't want to upset the status quo. You know, they don't want to be seen as those kinds of women. You know, they're afraid. You know, that's the other thing. Women are under siege. We're under siege. I mean, the porn industry makes more money than Hollywood. I mean, just think about that for a minute. Okay? Then you have, you know, sex trafficking and prostitution. You know, you have domestic violence. 1 in 2 women are going to be battered in her life by somebody who claims to love her. And you have 1 in 3 women are going to be raped. What? You know, nobody talks about those statistics out loud. You know anybody that's talking about those statistics out loud? That's really, 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 really happening to us. I mean, that's a horror story. You know, we have to get up and face that every single day. So, and what's happening out there in the culture is going to be happening inside our activist movements, unless we address it there before it happens there. And DGR is doing just that. What we do is we have a code of conduct, we have a set of principles, we have a strategy, we have an analysis, we're radical feminists to the core, and men that are coming into this organization have to be knowledgeable about radical feminism, our theory, our analysis, how we've arrived here, what's happening to women in the society. They have to be willing to check their privilege, to look at their sexist attitudes before they even get in the door, because we have an interview procedure that people have to go through. We want to make sure that you are on the same page, okay? And now if somebody had told me 10 years ago that I would be working alongside male allies in a radical feminist organization, I would have, I don't know what I would do. I would have balked for sure. You know, I definitely would have probably laughed, you know, like, no, that's never going to happen. And here I am, and I'm doing it, and it's working. You know, women in this organization are safe, and they're thereby powerful. And the men that are in this organization have our back. And I feel absolutely secure in that, and I feel honored to work beside them. So this works. Unlike in, say, you know, an Occupy Wall Street movement where this wasn't addressed. I mean, nothing was really addressed in advance, and it was part of the Occupy Wall Street problem. It was a rupture, but it hadn't been planned for. So many, many difficulties came up. But just as an example, you know, what was playing out in the camps, you know, was abuse against women. So if it's going on in society, it's going to be going on in the movements unless it's addressed before men get in the door. And I know from having the Occupy Wall Street Zapatistas come to speak with our group that they have also addressed this situation in their own movement. And I was rather shocked when they had said that out of everything that they had faced as a movement, the hardest thing for them to face was their machismo. I was like, wow. I was completely blown out of the water when they said that. I thought that was a very bold statement. I thought it was a very true statement. And, you know, courageous, very, very courageous. And so, I mean, I don't want to speak for them, but I think that, you know, that's how it needs to be addressed. And
okay. I've been long fascinated by sectarianism on the left. And there's so few of us, really, who are active. And we're divvied up into all these different political lines. And meanwhile, the system, of course, the capitalist system thrives completely on divide and conquer, which is why, you know, they're really kicking our asses, even though there are so many conditions that are ripe for recruitment among the masses that we should be doing a lot better than we're doing. And so I've been, you know, I've mulled that over for a long time and discussed it with a lot of friends, and certainly in Occupy. And I always keep thinking back of a story. I don't know. It might be apocryphal, but, Shah Massoud, who was a leader of the, anti-Soviet Afghan Mujahideen, whose politics I do not agree with, and I assume would not be widely shared in this room. Nevertheless, had something interesting to say. He supposedly gathered members of the Afghan resistance, different sects, different political parties, different tribes, different people who spoke different languages, and finally got them to the representatives together to discuss what to do about the Russians. And he supposedly held up his cup of tea and said, first, we kill the Russians. Next, we kill each other. And I think that that level of focus is very, very important. Like, first, let's kill the capitalists, and then we'll kill each other and try to figure out how we're going to. And I do mean that completely theoretically, but in a sense, that is the role. That is what happens in a revolution. First, in a revolution, the dominant power structure, the military and the political and the business elite have to be thrown out of power. They have to be completely disenfranchised. The people who have been disenfranchised have to replace them in ruling the nation state and whatever other form of regime follows. That has to happen. And then there's going to be a shaking out period as society discusses how it wants to move forward and what comes next. And some of that shaking out will be nonviolent discussion, and some of it will probably be violent violence in nature, at least if history repeats itself. And I think that what is lacking here, I usually really hate the language of a change of attitude or a revolutionary mindset change, because it seems very airy and fluffy to me. But in this particular aspect, we on the left, and everybody who opposes the system, and I argue this in the Anti-American Manifesto and got a lot of grief for it, we have to make alliances of convenience with anyone and everyone who is willing to fight the dominant system, because they have so many advantages as it stands, militarily, the security state, the NSA, the police, the weapons. I don't need to go on and on. You know the advantages that they have. So that we need to be as united as possible in confronting that. And that's not to take away any of the divisions in terms of tactics and ideological line, but really, truly, if someone's version of socialism is a smidge different than mine, we should just argue about that over beers and go and fight the capitalists the rest of the time, and maybe we can kill each other later.
This idea of like a culture resistance, and I think when I first started getting into activism, this term culture resistance has really been another one of those amorphous terms for me, but I think something that I am starting to understand a little bit better. And I think it is this fine balance, as with anything in the world. It's something that I've seen here, especially in New York City and in the activist scene here in the U.S., is this hyper-inclusivity, that we want to love everyone. And anyone and everyone of any term or politics is allowed in. And I think what has happened is this hyper individualism that is like the neoliberal effects on our psyche, which is we are all children of neoliberalism, and everything we do comes from this individualistic attitude. And I think some of the things that we talked about with the role of women, the sexual violence that happened in Occupy, I think is something that people don't want to talk about. The sexual violence that happens in groups because of a fear of structure, because of a fear of excluding the individual for some greater cause, I think is this idea of creating this culture of resistance, that we need to have structures in place, that there are codes of conduct. It is inappropriate to do certain things, regardless of your politics, because we are human beings first and political creatures second. And, we are fighting for a world where these oppressions don't occur. And if we allow this into our culture, it infects it's like a virus in our culture, and it destroys these groups. And I think then that leads to this other idea of how do we prepare ourselves in this culture resistance. And I think we're lucky to have the example of COINTELPRO, which, there are people here who have probably lived through that. And I only read this through books. And, the extent of COINTELPRO is vast. I mean, people had children with activists who 30 years later comes out that they were working for the FBI, the CIA, the whole time. I mean, the scale of that kind of complicity in an oppressive system is mind-blowing. And what we have now, I mean, thank you to Edward Snowden for releasing these files, that now we can see the scale of what has happened. You know, as a member of DGR, we are going through our own internet sectarianism. And you know, interestingly enough, there was a PowerPoint presentation put out by the NSA showing point by point how to split groups up using social media, which is something that, you know, obviously I'm a biased opinion, but I believe that the sectarianism that we are seeing in many groups, this idea of, you know, we fight over small details of certain aspects of a point, or who the oppressive Olympics is another very valid one. And these are all neoliberal arguments that are used by the NSA to split these groups apart. And I think that this idea of you know, having that balance between, yes, we need structure, we need to protect our cultures, and we need to protect the people in those cultures, but at the same time, what are we actually disagreeing on, I think, is the bigger question. Is this something that is fundamental to the arguments? You know, my father is a Tea Party member. We are probably not going to get along on fundamental levels. You know, but a socialist and a anarchist, I think that those differences need to be put aside until a later date. Because until capitalism is taken down, it doesn't matter if there's socialism and anarchist groups on Thursday nights. Because there is a larger fight that we need to be working on.
Part of the destruction of indigenous culture by capitalism was a conscious destruction of a competing ethic. Capitalism can only define itself by what it's against. Because what it is repugnant. It's about greed, profit, hoarding, exploitation, the commodification of the earth, of human beings. And indigenous societies have an ethic that is traditionally diametrically opposed to capitalism. Those who hoard and keep for themselves within an indigenous society are distrusted, if not despised. Everything is communal. Within an indigenous culture, you recognize the capacity for the sacred. Things have an intrinsic value beyond their monetary value. All of this is antithetical to capitalism, and as Marx correctly pointed out, capitalism didn't just bring with it a form of economic exploitation, but a peculiar ideology that becomes inculcated in the dominant culture. And I think part of the ruthlessness, especially in the United States, towards indigenous cultures was that they could not allow that competing ethic to exist side by side with capitalism. And so they killed it, and they put indigenous peoples in concentration camps. And that's what they were called, prisoners of war camps, before they became tribal agencies and everything else, and made them and removed their capacity for self sustenance and self-maintenance to make them dependent on the capitalist culture which exists to this day. So I think it's important that if we're going to survive as a planet, I mean, the indigenous movements around the globe have taken the lead on this, I think not accidentally, because they have retained a residue of that way of looking and relating to the world that we must go back and recapture if we're going to survive as a species.
Right quick, I want to say that in terms of culture of resistance, one of the things we need to focus on is the culture of individualism that has been fostered by the commodification of culture that's so prevalent today in society, and that in progressive circles, in militant circles, in revolutionary circles, in circles of struggle, we need to focus on building anti-individualism and promoting anti-individualism in the form of collectivist approaches. We need to collectivize our resources. We need to collectivize the way that we spread the word. We need to be able to take away the face behind the message and have the people listen to the message and not just be fixated on the face. And it's something that's really hard in America, because we've also so been brainwashed in believing that individualism is the essence of life, but individualism really is fruitful in most fruitful when it expresses itself in collectivism, and that's, I think that's the approach that we need to build. One last thing I'd like to say is really one of the main reasons why I'm here tonight is because I think one struggle, I represent one struggle, is a movement that is based on the concept of the intermediate level. And it's precisely trying to address the sectarianism that exists in the left today. And it's kind of like almost a social experiment. It started out in, mostly in South Florida, in Miami and in Fort Lauderdale, but it's trying to spread its wings. And, the idea of the intermediate level is that it represents a level where we don't need to agree necessarily about what we're going to do after the revolution happens, but we need to take strong stances in how to fight against capitalism and fight against imperialism, and we need to pull our resources together. So One Circle has had some success in Florida in terms of organizing. We've hit upon some hurdles here in New York, but I think that as a project of the left, because the idea of One Struggle is not to create another little group on top of the little group. If this can work, if this can have some appeal, and if people can agree to organize themselves and partake in collective action against capitalism, against imperialism, then it's something that maybe is applicable to this time. If not, then it will come about further down the road when the level of mass struggle here in the United States is at another level. But I still want to pitch it out to people to keep it in your mind, because it's something that we can do if we really want to be anti-sectarian on a very non-reformist level. As anti-capitalists and as anti-imperialists, there's things that we can do together. And you have had, particularly in Florida, you've had groups on the left, anarchists, Trotskyists, Maoists, Leninists. I mean, you can come up with all the is, and we're working together. So it is possible. And I just want to throw it out as a challenge to people here in New York. Say, hey, if this is something that can help us as a bridge or as a way to embrace not our divisions but what unites us in our struggles, then let's give it a crack.
And I'll be very brief. One can say that we've all benefited from indigenous genocide to one extent or another. I should commence first as well, because the concept of indigenous, we've all probably infer immediately indigenous, like brown people or whatever, like part Latino people. But indigenous people, as we recognize and as the United Nations recognize, I know we don't love the United Nations here. I don't love the United Nations. Be that as it may, the definition is effective. The definition of indigenous recognizes people internationally. So it's not just people from the original Western Hemisphere. It's also like the Samis from Norway and the Celtic from Ireland. So to an extent, we can say we are all indigenous deep in our deep roots. We just have to reach that out and connect with that. Be that as it may, when we picture indigenous genocide, we limit ourselves to thinking of the domestic United States, the entire Western Hemisphere, or the entire planet. I already said this that way. One example of a way in which people have benefited from indigenous genocide have worked to broaden our solidarity and liberation struggles to the return. They have returned the high percentage of lands in New Zealand, which is awesome. They've returned to the people, the original people there. And there are many products and businesses which we should all divest and boycott. There are Spanish companies in Oaxaca. I've seen them up front. We believe like windmills are this great and beautiful thing that are benefiting our lives. It's planned to be the biggest windmill center in the world in Oaxaca. It's already being established. The reason is because Oaxaca has the biggest wind density in the world because of these two currents that are very strong. And these windmills, they're not benefiting the indigenous people there. They're sending the energy up to the United States and selling them there, you know, in battery form, basically, to businesses like Walmart and Best Buy. And it's going on already. So we have to connect with our brothers and sisters. With our brothers and sisters, I have to emphasize this, basically. You know, we should see our
people who probably seem Latino, we can't assume they're Latino. They are many times indigenous. And the Latino people themselves have to dig and reach for the indigenous food. We all have to reach for indigenous because we all are a great humanity. And, how can I say? We have to connect, and there's a great possibility to that. And I see with you said, like, people connecting with the land and making their own food. That's a beautiful thing. We have to, like, stop, how can I say, splitting ourselves up with these, terminologies as well. I'm using indigenous, of course. It is a terminology, but I want to use it to, like, unify. And of course, indigenous people as well, we prefer our roots and our specific ancestors, specific, tribes or whatnot. You know, I'm Chibcha, Mixteca, and it's a beautiful thing also to connect our distinctions as well. But there's sometimes an issue, like when we, the hipster or whatnot. I live in Williamsburg my whole life. Of course, I'm accustomed to the change. But we have to embrace each other. And for that, we have to humble ourselves and connect with one another. Recently, I'm going to say this one last point. Recently, there's a Cuban doctor who's recognized by Obama as well, and he's given awards or whatnot. He states that 80% of illness and sickness is due to our location and our place in society. So he's set up a doctor, an attorney, and a social worker to go to homes and help people. You know, because the hospitals, some people don't have access. You know, we can often blame where we are, you know, to what has happened to us. So it's nice that people are coming out into the neighborhoods, but they shouldn't walk over the neighborhoods. We should reach, connect, you know. It's like we have to understand each other's cultures. That's a very important thing. We really have to reach out, humble ourselves, and perhaps let our people lead. And, you know, it's a beautiful thing, like, give your fellow human a voice, an opportunity. And thank you. Thank you again for this opportunity. Tlasukamati Sijika.
Most revolutions are not violent. Most revolutions happen when the foot soldiers of the elite will no longer employ force to protect the elite. That was true in 79 in Iran. That was true in Petrograd when they sent the Cossacks in to quell the bread riots. They refused. They fraternized with the crowd. The Tsar was rushed back on a train and had to abdicate in a railway carriage. That was true when I covered the fall of East Germany. 70,000 people were marching in Leipzig. Honecker, who had been the dictator for 19 years, sent down an elite paratroop division to fire on the crowd. They refused. Honecker lasted another week in power. What happens, and this gets to what Berkman writes about, is that a discredited, corrupt, venal elite, which we certainly have, can no longer be protected by the internal forms of security. No revolution has ever succeeded that I know of in actually defeating an armed force, the military forces. Well, the Cuban Revolution, I mean, Castro never had much in terms of numbers in the Sierra Madre. You have to remember the Cuban Revolution was accompanied by massive strikes, protest movements, non-cooperation movements. If you can look again at the ANC, you saw a beginning with Spear of the Nation, but by the end it was non-cooperation that brought down the apartheid regime. So violence is part of revolutions. But what happens in order for a revolution to succeed is that the will to power on the part of the security agencies that protect the elite evaporates, and they are no longer willing. That is the final kind of denouement of a revolution itself, which was true even in the Russian Revolution. So I think it's a bit of a misnomer. I mean, oftentimes groups that seize power, whether it was the Bolsheviks or even in Cuba, remember, they become the dominant classes, and so they write the historical narrative. But the real revolution, which we don't understand in Russia, was an anarchist revolution. The Soviets were anarchist entities that Lenin and the Bolsheviks consciously dismantled and destroyed, and then subsequently the anarchist movement was decimated. I mean, people were executed by the Cheka. So, and for that reason, we don't even have it's very difficult for us to have even an honest narrative of what took place in the revolution. But I would argue that most revolutions are at their core not actually violent.
Normally happens is that the ruling powers, the political and military elites, at the final stage of any kind of radical transformation, politically or otherwise, they run for their lives, and pretty much the insurgents can walk into the corridors of power. But that doesn't happen by itself. That happens at the end of a long historical process that almost, well, I will say, historically has never not included violence as part of its narrative. Again, we're getting back to the fuzziness about what a revolution is. Don't mention the ANC. There was never a revolution in South Africa. And you can tell that because white people still have all the money there. The classes did not change. The class system remains intact. Gandhi did not, by the way, not that the Indian independence struggle was purely nonviolent anyway, far from it, but even if we assume that it was, there was never a revolution there. The Indian caste and class structure remained intact pretty much. And that's why the British did business with Gandhi. If you look at the real revolutions, the big name capital R revolutions, Cuba, China, Russia, France, you're looking at violent struggles. And that's because in the final analysis, people who have power and privilege do not give it up voluntarily. No one is going to come up. I mean, you know, maybe some of us here are idealistic enough to be willing to give up our power and privilege, but there aren't very many of us, and we don't have that much power and privilege. But when you are Warren Buffett or Bill Gates or these people, the people in the Pentagon, they're not going away quietly. And yes, you're not doing it without nonviolence. Nonviolent struggle is a huge component of revolution, but no successful, that's the key word, no successful revolution has ever happened any other way. And I think that, I think that on the left, a lot of people don't want to address this because they're afraid of how brutal revolution is because it goes so wrong so often. History shows so many examples of the Cultural Revolution going off the skids. The French Revolution led to Napoleon and 100 years of chaos and so on, that they just don't want to it's too hard, it's too violent, it's too brutal, might not even work, we might end up with something even worse. And we start to think, we could do this some other way. But really, and it is true, if you can reform your system and it's worth reforming into something better, you should. Revolution's not something you should take up lightly. It's the, in case of emergency, please break glass. Now I see an emergency, planetary crisis is just one of them. For me, it's the big one. But I think that, the objection often is, to address your point, I hear this a lot. People say, we're not going to be able to take on the state militarily. We're not going to be able to go head up to the Adirondacks and fight off the state. That's for sure, no question. But that said, every single revolutionary movement has always been outfunded and outarmed by a superior nation state, no question. I mean, Louis XVI could have had all the French revolutionaries killed. The Tsar could have prevailed militarily. But what happens at a certain point, as Chris described, is at a certain point, the will to power ends. There's a radicalization that spreads even into the middle echelon of the authority structure, whether it's the police or even members of the military, where they're no longer willing to kill their fellow citizens, and they start to view them not as subjects, but as comrades. And they just stand out. They might not lead, they might not follow, but they get out of the way. And that's what happens in the final analysis. But I think, we're not taking these fuckers on with AKs in the hills. But the point is, it's not going to be a fair fight. I'm reading right now, a book called The Embers of War about the Vietnamese independence struggle against the French. from 1946 to 1954. Fascinating book. And it's, you know, I mean, it's all prequel to the American experience in Vietnam, where Ho Chi Minh met with his French negotiating counterpart in Paris in 1946. And he said, and the French guy said, listen, we're going to kill all you guys. You know, we have better weapons. We have better training. We have more men. We have the French Empire. We're fucking France. And even though we've just had our asses kicked, we're still going to kill you all. And Ho Chi Minh said, yes, absolutely. You are right. You are going to kill many, many more of us. And in the final analysis, you will not be able to maintain the political will or the ability to crush us all. And in the end, we will win. And they did. And they had to do it twice. They had to do it against the French and the Americans. 2 million people dead, but they did kick us out. I mean, that's just history.
Okay, I just want to quickly come back to that point that he mentioned, and I think it's a very good one. No one who has the power is willing to give it up. So what makes us think if we are able to overthrow the current power, once we get it, we are going to give it up? So I think, and this should be at the core of the discussion, like, what are we willing, what do we want at the end? We just want a change of powers. We just want to be just changing the ruling class to set another ruling class, because at the end, that's what's going to happen. I mean, most likely, yeah, things may be get better for some part of the population, but at the end, we're going to most likely end up with just a system that has a different people in the power, but that preserves itself. So I think we really... the Zapatistas make it clear, and I think we can learn a lot of the indigenous people, because as Chris mentioned, they have just a so different set of minds. They say we don't want the power, we just want to live in peace. That's it. I mean, they're not making a revolution to overthrow the Mexican power and now to be the rulers of the countries. They just want to live in peace, and I think that's basically what we all want. So we have to ask ourselves, do we want the power? Or more importantly, let's say we just make a revolution right now and we win. What are we going to do? And I think that if we are not ready to answer that question, we better don't start to unleash something that we don't even know where it's going to end.
I think that there are some concepts that have been tossed around that have definitely blurred a whole lot of lines. Revolution is one of them. Exploitation is another one. And within... different conceptual schemes. For example, I'll just take a brief example about exploitation. When you have a capitalist speak of exploitation, he'll say that, well, if I'm paying my worker a fair wage, he's not being exploited. But from the standpoint of the working class, where surplus social value is being extracted, the process of capitalist production itself is a process of exploitation. So I think that for workers, there's no such thing as a fair wage. There's no way the capitalist ever can pay us a fair wage. Fair wages don't exist in capitalism because we are all always being exploited. And it's the same thing about revolutions. So you have tons of historical events where you have regime overthrows, and they want to make us believe that regime overthrows equal revolution. And I think that from the standpoint of dominated classes, because capitalism took out feudalism centuries ago, so from the revolutions that need to be made, that are left to be made in this world, are the revolutions of the dominated classes against the dominant exploiting classes. So from that standpoint, it has nothing to do with regime change, but it has everything to do with a complete structural overflow, taking power, restructuring the economy, and developing an ideology that enables collectivism to really flourish. So I don't want to take too much time. I just want to just take two, three things right quick. If you think of it in that framework, that you need to be able to organize the dominated classes to restructure society in order to eliminate exploitation, you can see that it's not an easy process. It's a process that takes a high level of organization. And we're going into a higher, we're trying to construct a higher social organization, a higher way of, a better way of living. So that takes work also. That takes a lot of collective input. So if we take a brief look at America today, we can see that there's some missing key ingredients right now in terms of bringing a revolution about. We don't have the revolutionary organizational capacity right now to bring that about. We don't have even a revolutionary conjuncture. So that being said, I think that some things change very quickly, and the events of Occupy, for example, were events that woke up a lot of people here in America, and we need to take stock in the amount of creativity and genuine collective spirit that flourished during Occupy, notwithstanding everything that other lessons that we can learn also. Right quick, in the same line, I'd like to say that let's keep in mind that capitalism today, dominated by financial capital, is a Ponzi scheme. It will burst at some point. I mean, they can come up with formulas to repatch it and repatch it, but the essence of a Ponzi scheme is that eventually it will break down. Capitalism is also a paper tiger, and there are tons of examples in history that show us that no matter what the nuclear might of America might be, no matter what the military might of America might be, there's limited things that you can do with bombs. And people who have been opposed and struggle against imperialism have found ways over and over again to do these things. So imperialism is a paper tiger.